reminds me of surrender, because you never know where you're going to be when you get that moment of clarity or that advanced grace, and you know you're done. With that, I'll give you John Clark from the Superior Group.
Thanks, Bobby. Good evening, everybody. My name is Johnny. I'm an alcoholic. For those of you that care to, would you join me with the Serenity Prayer, please? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. I hope the Newberg Group don't got a resentment against my home group, Superior, for bumping you guys on the phone calls or whatever happened, but we try to do that once a year. They usually send out a request from central office or whatever. It's been a good experience for me, although I always do it on Sunday morning and the early shift and the phone don't ring for the most part. I walked up to Marty before the meeting. I said, Marty, I got 5 years. I want to join the group. He said, how do we know that? And he walked away. No, my name's Johnny. I'm an alcoholic. It's definitely an honor to lead this meeting. I'd like to thank Bobby for asking me before I forget, because I got a tendency to do that. I got my beginnings right here in this room. Here, Doan's Men, Broadway, Harvard, all three of these meetings. I've been privileged to lead all three of them, too, and this is the first time I ever spoke here. I've been coming here about 5 years pretty religiously. I learned a lot of stuff in this room, a lot of characters. Some of them are gone now, God rest their soul, but the things that they told me I still subscribe to today. You know, one of the biggest things I heard Marty say early on was, you want to feel good, do good. And I think the place I was at then, that it made sense to me. If I'd heard something like that before, I'd have said, he's a sap. It wouldn't have made any sense, but it made perfect sense to me. So, you know, Newberg's been good to me. Some of the guys I look over in their seats, I miss them, you know, seeing them there. We all know who they were. You know, they were people that, you know, Chuck Walsh talks about listening with your eyes, and these guys I watch, you know. It wasn't so much what they said as what they did, but occasionally they drop one line around me that would, like, hit me between the eyes, and that's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never thought I was going to get sober. You know, I never thought. The book talks about being in a place where you accept that as your lot, and then you try to go on to the bitter end, blotting out whatever consciousness you can. That's where I was at in my life. I wanted to get sober at times, but I didn't have the willingness to do what people had told me. And I'd been around AA a long time since 1978, you know, some things happened that, you know, God gave me grace, and that's why I'm standing here tonight, and I'll take you through my story as quickly as possible. I grew up on the east side of Cleveland, in the Collinwood area. Things was pretty good. The neighborhood then was pretty close-knit. It was, you know, there was a lot of different elements of people, a lot of different things. I can remember this. There's things that I like that I always say in my leading. If you've heard me before, you're going to hear them again tonight, because I think it's important for me to remember these things. As a youngster, I remember growing up, and my dad was an alcoholic. He died with 22 years in this program. He died in 04. And I would be out in the neighborhood with my buddies, and I'd see him staggering up 152nd Street, you know, disheveled, just what the... You think about a textbook look of an alcoholic, you know, because he'd be out for a week or two. He would go from one joint to another and go sleep somewhere and be right back in Ryan's at 5:30 or whatever time they cracked the door. They opened it early. And, you know, at times I'd be with my friends and we'd see him. And my buddies would go, ain't that your pops? And I remember being feeling ashamed. But what's significant here is that I remember saying to myself that I'm never going to end up like that. I was a 9 or 10 year old kid, and I knew that, I wasn't going to turn into that. There was no way. I meant that with every fiber of my being. Now, because he was an alcoholic, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. But what it did was affect me profoundly. I heard this at the angle one night early on, a year or so sober. And the lead that night said, you know, for me to say that that didn't affect me, you know, what I went through in my upbringing, in my childhood, would be like me to say that what I did in my alcoholism didn't affect other people. And I know that it did. It affected them profoundly. And it still does today with my character defects. You know, so that said, you know, that just set the stage for whatever. So my mother, God rest her soul, too. I've lost both of them since I've been sober. And she was a saint. She picked up the slack. She did whatever was needed to do to keep the household going. She worked 10, 12 hours a day in a machine shop in Euclid. She tried to instill morals and values in us, and she couldn't afford to send us to parochial schools, but she sent, made us go to catechism, you know. You know, and I turned my back on the church. I didn't want anything to do with that, you know, at that time. So what happened was, with all that free time, I started to gravitate towards the kids that were from families like me, you know, these kids. You know, I don't know if you want to call them troubled kids, kids from broken homes, whatever. You know, you could spot them. You could spot them, and I, you know, I'm right with them. So we looked up to the criminal elements in the neighborhood. We looked up to the gangsters, the Hell's Angels, whatever was going on over there, organized crime, whatever. And we aspired to be like them flashy guys. You know, and one day I nonchalantly took a drink with some older guys, and you know, you hear it from the podium a lot, the ease and comfort that you feel that comes with it. I got that right away. You know, I drank till I got violently ill, and I couldn't wait to do it again. It just gave me a feeling. It filled up something in me. I don't know what it was. I never quite felt connected or like everyone else. I'd always wonder, why don't people feel or think like I do or whatever? And it, I don't know. I still to this day can't put my finger on that. But what happened was, you know, our philosophy, our attitude, our mindset, if you will, at that time was, you know, why work? Why we can steal your stuff? Or why do anything? And, you know, you take a kid drinking like that with an attitude like that, before long he was in trouble. And what happened to me was from 1973 I went to the Ohio Youth Commission, they called it at the time, at Mohican Youth Camp. Up until 1977, I opened the doors of Indian River, which is a maximum security juvenile facility that they opened to get the minors out of Mansfield, out of E-Dorm out there. And a couple of things happened along the way that they're important. But, you know, I tell you this to tell you that I spent the formative years with the state of Ohio. My folks would get it together. They'd come up and see me, and they'd talk to me. And I could remember a kind counselor calling me in, an older lady, an elderly lady, I should say, and taking time with me and trying to talk to me. And she was nice to me. And, you know, why is it that you do these things, you know, at home? Why do you drink and do these things and get in trouble? And she posed a question to me, and I said, you know, it just seems like a fair question. So the best answer I could muster after giving it some thought was that, well, it made me feel better. She goes, well, what is it that you're trying to feel better from? Why don't we take a look at that, and maybe we can get you straightened out, and you ain't got to come back here. First of all, I wasn't willing to make the connection that what I did on the street had anything to do with me being there. What had to do with me being there was I was too stupid, and I parked the car too close, and they got the license number or whatever. And maybe I was just a nice guy that drank a little too much. But, you know, I wasn't willing to look at that then. Fast forward a couple more years, a chaplain lad, he took us to a Baptist church in Mansfield. At that time, they could take guys if you were trustworthy or whatever. They put you in a state car and take you wherever. And I don't know why he selected me, just said, I want you to go here. And it was a Baptist church, and I'm not trying to disparage Baptists, but I'd never been to a service like that, and it was a little different for me. You know, their service is a little different than Catholicism. But afterwards is what's important here, what's significant. He took us to the reformatory, which was right around the corner, to Ohio State Reformatory. And it was this time of the year, fall time of the year. And I can remember it was like a 69 or 70 Chevy state car station wagon. It was gold, had the cage in the back, and he rolled up in front of the reformatory. And if you've ever seen the reformatory, it's a pretty imposing structure. And if you haven't, you can go over to Jones, three-quarter. Jack's got a nice mural-sized aerial photo of it over there because it's not all there anymore. But anyways, he took us over to the parking lot, and he turned the car off, and he turned around, and there was four or five of us in the car, and he sat there, and he tried to talk to us. He said, this is where you guys are going to end up if you don't change your ways. This is what's going to happen to you. And the radio in the car was on the same frequency, and you could hear the guards squawking. You could hear them rolling the gates. The lights were on, you know, and I sat back there and I scoffed at him. I said, I didn't say it to him, but I'm thinking, no, old man, you got me messed up. I ain't going to end up there because I'm going to make my move this time. It's going to be different. I know where I made my mistakes, and I'm never going there. October 1978, driving right by that very spot, sitting in the back of the Cuyahoga County Sheriff van, looking down there right where we were parked that night, and I don't know what you'd call it, a tap from God, something, just feeling, you know, maybe I should listen to these people. This guy, you know, he all but predicted this. And by the time I got from that spot to going to the reception, to the to the bullpen in there, my thinking changed. You know, I was like, well, you know, if you do what we do, going to prison's an occupational hazard. So you're going to do that. It's going to happen. And I went in there, and it was like old home week. A lot of guys I was in reform school with, a lot of guys from my neighborhood, you know, they just seemed to reoffend, whatever. They're there. 3.5 years down there, nothing changed, nothing happened. One good thing came out of there, and that was my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been in AA meetings before. I used to go in the old Conlon group on 175th and St. Clair. My dad would be in there at times, and I'd go in there to hit him for $10 or whatever, and they'd be playing cards and whatever, and these guys older than dirt would be throwing lines at me, and I got to go, and I'd be out of there. But down here, and I always mention him, you know, a group of guys brought a meeting from Cleveland every week. I always mention Joe German, you know, God rest his soul. He was a little firebrand, and he, you know, he had a ragtag cast of characters he brought. And, you know, at that time, my dad would be in and out, and he'd say, well, why don't you try to talk to my kid, Joe? He knows he's going out. So he'd send for me in the yard, and they'd come up and say, hey, you got to go up there. He wants you. And I'd tell my buddies, you know, I got to go up there. And I go up there. I say, Joe, you know, the only reason these guys come down here or up here is for the coffee and cigarettes. He goes, yeah, we know that. That's our hook. We lure you up here with that. They lock the door, and you got to listen to us for an hour. Maybe, just maybe, we'll get through to one of you dummies. And then I used to say, Joe, what do you come down here for? I always thought there was some kind of stipend or fund. I said, you know, what do you got? Some state and some county money? Blah, 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 blah. He said, no. And I'll tell you the truth, honest to God, as I stand here tonight, that I looked at him, and when he was trying to explain the concept of 12-step work to me, I was looking at him in the face, nodding and smiling, thinking, you're a liar. There's something up. You wouldn't be coming down here for nothing. Because, you see, at that point in my life, up until that point, I had evolved into a person that didn't have a conscious thought about another human being on the face of this earth. It didn't matter. You know, I might express a little bit of feelings, but or maybe show it outwardly, you know, like, oh, boy, that's bad, you know, but I really didn't care. I'd step right over them. It wouldn't matter to me. And I'm ashamed to say that, but that's how it was. That's where, you know, alcoholism had taken me and my thinking. That's where I had taken me. So what happened was Four more times to prison, and more than half my life spent behind bars. I spent a lot of lonely nights in cells. I spent a lot of time in the hole because I was a loudmouth and a troublemaker, and I was full of rage, scared to death, full of fear. I went from getting out of, like, the reform schools, you know, on his release day, sitting up in the administration building, waiting for someone to come and get me or go to the bus station, and I had a plan. I was going to take this money they give you, the gate money or whatever, and I was going to go pick up Betty Lou, and I was going to go see so-and-so, and it was on. I knew it. That was my plan. It went from that to sitting in a bullpen, getting ready to be released and being scared to death, full of fear, not knowing what to do. You know, knowing that I was going to go out and the madness would start again. I might say differently, but I knew inside, that's all I knew, you know, scared to death. And what happened was, is I, you know, I spent more than 20 years inside, and I evolved a mentality. I call it a convict mentality, and that's what I talk to the guys. That's what I talk to people that I work with that are like, that were like me or are like me now, you know, because we think in a certain way. And I say this, and I don't know if this is true, but this is just my opinion, that, you know, they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, selfish and self-centeredness being, you know, the root of our problem. I've seen, you know, selfish and self-centeredness. I've seen a, in prison, if you have ever been there, if it's possible, there's a degree higher of selfishness and self-centeredness. You take an ex-convict or a convict alcoholic in an atmosphere like that, you know, it's all about me. It's number one, law of the jungle, and a lot of things happen down there, and it's not pretty. So when I came out, I was like full of hate, full of rage. I didn't know what to do. I hated everybody. And I went on bumping around, doing the same thing, and I got to a place. They told me it would probably happen, but I didn't believe it. You know, and they talk about it in the book. I got in a place of incomprehensible demoralization where I started contemplating suicide. Suicide seemed like a viable option. You know, it struck firsthand in my family not a couple weeks ago. Somebody that was with us in the fellowship that went back out, and they decided to take a gun and you know, put it under their chin and their life, just like that. A cousin of mine. So, you know, it does happen, and I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen with people sober. But I wasn't willing to get sober. So what happened was, you know, I was bumping around out there doing pretty much what I wanted to do every day, and you know, I got to the point where I used to hate to hear the birds chirp in the spring when it wake me up. And I know I needed a drink. I knew I was going to go out. See, I like to drink. But when I ran out of drink, I didn't like to work. So I heard Vic Zublik say it, and it fit me to a T. So I didn't want to work, so I just robbed somebody. And that's, you know, what I do. And, you know, society has places for people that do that don't play nice. We already talked about the first half of my life. So that's, you know, that's where I was headed to. What happened was, this chain of events that happened was, I got arrested up in Richmond Heights at the mall. That's a long story, but anyway, make a long story short, I got arrested for a theft up there. I went in front of Mary Kay Boza. I never seen Mary Kay Boza before. I was up there once with my girl, and she didn't like her. They didn't work. They clashed. She took her away. But, she, you know, this day they haul me out in Richmond Heights, and they don't even take you to court no more. They got a TV set up, you know. And she's on the camera, and she says, "How do you plead, you know, to the theft charge at Kaufman's?" I said, "Well, guilty. Guilty. I never said that before. The best you could get out of me was a no contest, and that was usually with some, you know, spontaneous pro se motion to suppress something or whatever. But this day I couldn't get, I had nothing left, you know. I said, I did it. I'm guilty." And she imposed a 180-day sentence on me, which is the max. So my keen alcoholic mind says, "Well, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Where's the consideration for the guilty plea?" You know? And she just snapped on me. She started frothing at the mouth and yelling and blah, blah, blah. And she asked me, "Do you do you have a drinking problem? And, you know, I've been asked that by many judges. And early on, I used to play that card all the time, you know. It was fine, but then I got one, I think it was Coyne, told me, because, you know, that's wore out. You know what's going to happen when you go out and drink, go to reformatory or whatever. But I told her yes. And I'd said that before, you know, but it was the truth. And that was the way, I wasn't looking to get out of anything, but yeah, I did. She goes, all right, well, I'll tell you what. If you still want treatment at halftime, you write me a letter, I'll see that you get it. She goes, get him out of here, turn the camera off. And my grateful response to her was, yeah, I heard that before. And they, you know, they drugged me out of there. So what happened was, long story short, they don't keep you at Lynn, or they don't keep you at Richmond Heights. It's a five-day facility. I end up at Bedford. And I know I'm going to have some problems with my detox. They want to put me in this dorm that is full of youngsters with bandanas tied around their heads and stuff. And I says, I'm not going in there. And the jailer's like, well, what do you mean you're not going? I said, you heard what I said. I said, put me in a hole. He goes, we don't have a hole here. I go, really? So they took me over in the federal range and put me in there, and I slept, and about 5 in the morning they woke me up and they said, we're getting rid of you, you're going down to Morrow County. So they shipped me down there, and I swaggered in down there, and the jail administrator came out and he goes, oh, we ain't going to have none of that down here. You know, I'm already talking about minimum standards, and I know what I got coming, and blah, blah, blah. We're going to change some things down here. I lasted about 2 weeks, and they said, for your safety and ours, we're just gonna lock you down up here in the cell till you leave. How's that? I go, whatever. So I was up there in that cell about 3 months, a little more, and I lasted about 2 weeks. My point is that the time for halftime had come and gone, and I was sitting in that cell, and I wouldn't give her the opportunity to deny it. You know, I know if I shoot the letter, she's going to deny it. Then I'm really going to get a resentment. I'll probably roll over there and when I get out. Anyways, here's what happened. But one night, you know, they got to give you a shower every day. One night they cracked me out for a shower. I got my commissary flip-flops on, a state towel on. I go down. The officer that came, me and him did not get along. We clashed at that every opportunity. And, looking back on it now, I realize that he was a lot like me. That's probably why. He was a loud mouth, as was I, and he had pride and macho prison guard mentality or whatever. So he's taking me down to the shower. He's giving me the business all the way down. He's taking me up, back up, and he's saying this and he's saying that. And we get to the top of the stairs. He puts my cell was right at the top. He puts a key in a lock, and he opened it. And just the way he looked at me, and said, get in that cell. I wanted to, like, scoop him up and throw him over the tier. I really did. That's how full of rage I was. But I knew I had better say, I knew that if I did anything to him that I would never get out. And then there it was. This was it right here. I didn't know. This was just a regular day. I didn't know. At that instant, I looked down in the day room, and I seen what was happening. You know, the chaos, the dude on the phone arguing with his old lady, these guys standing in front of the plane that they ain't even bars no more, glass. You look out with their hands down their pants, and I just said, God help me. God help me. I can't do this no more. I don't belong here. And I went in that cell that night, and I sat down, and I wrote Dear Judge Boza. And I slid it under the door. And, being a veteran of many, pro se legal litigation things, I know that the wheels of justice spin very slowly. A lot of times, the clerk just throws it in the garbage. But in this case, it seemed like it came back the next day. I know that's not the case. It's not possible. It was very, very, very quick. And the guy slid it under my door, and I looked. You know, at that time, I was corresponding a lot with the Supreme Court. The librarian down there was reading a lot of case law just for something to do because they'll send it to you free. And I looked, Lyndhurst Municipal Court, so I pick it up. There it was. The answer was yes. Two conditions. One was that you get your own ride. And the other was that you find your own place. So I'm thinking what to do here. I knock on the door. I show him the letter. I say, let me make a phone call. I can get out of here. So he said, okay, let me out. I go down. I call my dad. He's still alive. My dad worked for a time for Jack down at Stella Maris. He ran the dorm for him for a while. I knew he knew Jack. Jack had seen my act many a times down at Stella. And he'd say, why don't you go over to the dorm? No. I got this. I know what I got to do. And usually I'd be drunk that same day. So what happened? Well, he said, I got my father on the phone. He goes, what do you want me to do? I said, why don't you call Jack for me? He goes, well, what's up? I said, I'm done. I mean it. It's different. And he must have heard something in my voice. He believed me. So he called Jack, a couple faxes, exchanged hands, and the next thing I know, I'm standing on Jones Road with my father and Jack. And there's Jack with that smile. And he says to me, how much time have you been in jail since I seen you last? I said, probably a lot, most of it. And then, you know, I knew it was coming because it always came, not just from him, but from anybody else that, excuse me, had anything to do with this fellowship. You know, the $64,000 question, what are you willing to do? What are you willing to do to stay sober? And I looked him in the eyes. I told him, whatever I got to do, whatever you tell me. And I meant it. And he made me a promise that day. He made me two promises, actually. And both of them came to pass. And when I crossed that threshold over there at Jones, I made a pact with myself that I didn't know anything about staying sober. See, it was pretty easy for me because I had the streets and everything else had pile-driven me into a state of reasonableness, to a state of teachability that I didn't know anything. I really didn't. So a lot of those things came easy for me that I see people struggling with. And I have to be cognizant, I have to be patient with those guys. You know, because I fought for a lot of years, but once I was done, I was done. And, you know, I learned a lot of things. There's a couple things that are significant that I'll go over really quickly that are important. One day in the hallway over there, he came by me and he told me an ingrate won't stay sober. And I'm like, what's he talking about? I walk away, you know, and I'm thinking, it's grinding on me. I'm thinking, finally I come back, I go, what are you talking about? I help out around here. I mop up or whatever. He said, that's not what I'm talking about. And he said, you see that guy over there? It was a guy sitting on a chair, really bad shape, you know, disheveled, looked like he'd been in a dumpster sleeping, bad. He said, go talk to that guy. Really listen to him. So I said, okay. I went over and talked to him. If he was in the room tonight, I wouldn't know. I really wouldn't know. But I know this, that I talked to him for a while. I said, just stay here. He's going to make you sweat. Wait a while, but he's going to give you a bed. And sure enough, he said, take him upstairs. Me and a couple of the guys took him upstairs. Burn his clothes, he said. Shower him. Haircuts right there. Donation closet. Shined up. Comes down. Come downstairs. Sit down. I look at this man who was a hollow shell of a human being a minute ago. And I see him sitting there, and he's, you know, has this little bit of hope in his eyes, a little sparkle of hope. At that moment, I said, man, I took a bit of an inventory. I said, this feels pretty good. This is better than any drink or anything I ever had in my life before, you know. And then I was thinking, what's that Walsh guy say over there? You want to feel good, do good? And it clicked for me because I had been hearing about this and you know, the next thing that happened was, I says, hey, you know, because he was my go-to guy over there. If I had a big, you know, big phenomenal question, of course, I had to ask the director. And I said, you know, you talk about hearing about the spiritual angle, the spiritual aspect of the program. You got to have a higher power. You're going to stay. You're going to drink. You got to, you know. And I said, well, you know. I always had a problem with that. I don't know what to do. I guess I'm coming here looking for some kind of answer. And his response was pretty succinct. It was, what do you got to lose, a-hole? Okay. So I went upstairs and I knelt down in B3. What's B3? I said a prayer. It was a simple prayer. And I didn't really, you know, my praying skills weren't they were never, you know, but I got down on my knees and I asked God to remove the obsession. And I got up, and it was, I never had another excessive thought to drink. But I'll tell you that between that day and this day, I've got down on my knees every day, and I thank them mostly. Sometimes I get forgetful, and I believe that's being ungrateful too. So the obsession was removed. And one night right out here, he came out to the meeting and he said, sponsor that guy, and he walked away. And I'm like, whoa, come here, wait a minute. I'd been around about a year at the time. And I said, man, I don't know what to do. He goes, you know what to do. And he walked away from me. And of course, it was someone just like me, you know, in and out of prison, hard case guys. And there was a lot of them. And there was a lot of deaths and a lot of crazy stuff happening. And, you know, I'd trying to bend over backwards to do this stuff for these guys, almost like pump some of my sobriety into their veins or whatever, practically. And they'd get drunk or they'd lie, and I'd go to him and I'd whine. I go, can you believe what so-and-so did? He goes, listen, he straightened me out. He goes, you don't take credit whether they stay sober or whether they don't. You're sober, right? You get that? And I got it. So, you know, a lot of things have happened. I paid attention to them. Things that I would have, like, reasoned away or rationed before, you know. Oh, he didn't know what he was doing. He was stupid or whatever. You know, but then there was people that died that were very close to me that I knew. I sat with them for weeks and talked with them or even roomed with them. And I knew what the inner workings of their minds were as far as what they were telling. And then all of a sudden they're dead, you know. They'd have a bit of sobriety and they'd be dead. And one thing I noticed was that the guys that were alumni that had went through the house that came back and did things seemed to be the guys that were reasonably happy. And that's all they ever promised me here. So I said, I think I better do that. And I did that. And, it's kept me sober. You know, I was talking to somebody recently about character defects and stuff, and God knows, I've made a lot of mistakes in AA. I've done a lot of things. I still have a lot of anger issues. I still have a lot of control issues, you know. I heard somebody lead from Akron the other day, and they were talking about Drop the Rock. I have the book now, and I'm going to read it. I'm going to try to get it. Because I was talking to some other people that are a little more sober than me, and they told me around 5 years. Some of them describe it as dry. Some of them describe it as that their character defects were more apparent, more glaring, if you will. That's where I feel that I need work with those things. But the one thing I haven't done is pick up a drink, you know. And God gave me grace that day over there. And but there was like a little whisper with that, was that you know what you got to do to keep it. And I believe that. And I believe that I'm an alcoholic, and I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is my answer. There is the answer, you know, in the first 164 pages of the book and the steps. I never thought I'd get sober. I never did. And once I got there, I was blessed to know that, to believe that what was told to me and what I had to do to stay that way. You know, I still go to as many meetings a week as I can. I've never stopped coming here, even when I got out of the Keating Center. I wasn't here all last month because I was chairing at another meeting, and I seen someone's got their eye on my seat back there. I'm gonna get here at 5 next week to get it. But you know, it's been good to me. It's been great. You know, I've had the privilege of seeing some people recover and get restored back to their family, to their God. I've been even further privileged to see them step forward and help other alcoholics. You know, and I'm even working with a couple of guys now that have cars and driver's licenses, and I can delegate because my sponsor tells me you got to delegate. You know. And they got jobs too, and they can go. You know, if I call them up and say, "Hey, go pick up so and so," they're right on it. So it's like a network, you know, and that's how this thing works. And, you know, we try to help. I love my home group. I love Superior. You know, I do whatever I'm asked down there. They ask me to mop the floor. They ask me to be secretary. I don't care. You know, I'm grateful to be sober tonight. And I'm not going to keep you guys any longer. I'd like to thank Bobby again for asking me. And you say the Our Father. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses,